Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. I'm excited to have Robert Teschner on the show today. Robert is a combat veteran, fighter squadron commander, and founder and CEO of VMAX Group, a St. Louis-based national leadership training company. Well, Rob, I am so excited to have you here today with us, and I can't wait for our listening audience to hear your story. We have a real Top Gun Maverick guy with us, but it's not Maverick, it's Cujo. So it is wonderful to have you here with us, and I can't wait for people to hear your story. So I just want to go ahead and jump in. Let's talk about, walk us through a little bit about how you grew up.
Thank you, Lisa, for having me on this podcast. I think you're doing extraordinary work with it. In preparation for being here today, I had the privilege of listening to some of your previous interviews, and it's a fantastic job with an outstanding mission that you're bringing forward. So I'm privileged to be here today. All right.
We appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. And I'm also very, very blessed to have a background that warrants potentially being here. And I think about that all the time now that I have some distance from it. I was very, very fortunate to have had a career in the United States Air Force, to have served our nation, defending us forward as part of an outstanding team of teams. Along the way, I had the privilege of learning the fundamentals of leadership and practicing it for about 20 years, 24 if you count the Air Force Academy. And I've been part of high-performing teams for almost all of that time. Mm-hmm. I took all of that for granted, frankly, Lisa. While I was in active duty, it was just the thing that was. But now looking back on it, what an amazing education that I was blessed to have, mm-hmm. starting in the summer of 1991 when I went off to the Air Force Academy as a 17-year-old freshman, all the way through until the end, the last day of 2015. So I'm just so thankful for that. So we can talk about any of those pieces that you'd like to.
Absolutely. As you were talking, I was just thinking, sometimes I think it's our youth, you know, that we really don't really get it when we're younger. And then as we get older, we can look back and go, wow. You know, I think we just appreciate things more, you know, for all you youngsters out there.
Yes, that's right.
We appreciate things more as we mature, I feel like. And,
certainly.
And you can look back. So talk to me a little bit. Now, did you have people in your family that had been, you know, in the military? Were you thinking at a young age, this is what I wanted to do? And talk to us a little bit about that.
I was. So my family's history, long history of service. My grandfather specifically was a fighter pilot at the tail end of World War II, all right? So I grew up seeing pictures of the airplane that he was qualified in. My father was in the Air Force, and so I was born into an Air Force family. My father won the Bronze Star Medal in Vietnam. When he was getting ready to retire around 1989, I remember thinking, how are we going to survive not being in the Air Force any longer? This is my family. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was retiring, and it was a sad experience. All right, I did not want to leave. I had such a joy of being around the people that were always moving, experiencing new things together. When you were overseas, you're part of very tight-knit communities. And so for me, it was a race to get back in. I was just starting my junior year in high school, and I said, all right, there's no doubt about it. I must join up. And I had long ago decided that flying airplanes would be really neat. Top Gun came out, 1986 or so, mm-hmm. and that established that it must be, you know, fighter aviation for me. And so my junior year, I applied to the Air Force Academy, and I was blessed to initially be denied, but then on the very last day of my finals, my mom got a call from the senator's office saying that I got in. So I don't know how many people had turned down their appointments, but I was able to take that.
You were that next
I was the next person in line and got in there. And so that translates pretty nicely into now as a father, I mentioned to my kids all the time, if you want to win, you've got to play the game. You've got to put yourself out there, and you never know what might happen. Very, very fortunate to be part of the class of 1995.
That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. That's interesting because you had a disappointment. Probably when
yes.
you initially were turned down, you were probably very disappointed, right?
I certainly was. And I put a lot of eggs into that basket, frankly. Mm-hmm. So when that didn't come through, you know, it caused me to have to adjust and, you know, come up with a plan B.
Did you come up with a contingency plan?
I did. Okay. I created a contingency plan on the fly, and it was going to be a good one. And I'm sure everything would have turned out just fine if we had gone down that path. But it made the eventual acceptance even more powerful. Later on, I found out that two of my very, very good friends from the academy had also been denied acceptance, had also gotten in at the very last minute, and all of us went on to fly fighters. So that's kind of cool.
That is cool.
I wasn't alone.
Right. So you went to the Air Force Academy, mm-hmm. and you really had a pretty stellar career. And just kind of talk about that journey a little bit, how you started, what you ended up doing, because you ended up doing some really cool stuff.
Yeah. Blessed doesn't count, really. It's not powerful enough of a word to describe everything that happened to me. So the 4 years at the academy, the Air Force changed the rules on us. It was when I was accepted the fact that if you graduated with pilot qualification, you were going to go to pilot training. My freshman year, the chief of staff of the Air Force came to the academy and said, I'm sorry, we have too many pilots. Only 225 of you is going to go on to pilot training, and I'm really sorry for all of those of you who this affects. So the timing was right. I had still had 3 years to make sure that I was competitive, and I was blessed that the time that I spent there was well spent. I got to go through the glider program, did very well in the gliders. I got to go through the free fall parachuting program, did really well for that, and I was picked for the academy parachute team. I did really well militarily, and the sum total of all of these things plus my grades said I was one of the 225. And I got to go to Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, Texas, the Euro-NATO Joint Jet Pilot Training Program, and train with our NATO partners to become a pilot. Pilot training, it turns out, was a natural thing for me. So I was answering this call that was deep within me. I was really gifted at flying airplanes. I graduated top of my class. I got a chance to pick my airplane, and I picked the F-15, which was hand-assembled here at McDonnell Douglas, St. Louis, Missouri.
So, where I started my career.
Oh, my
gosh. And Greg did, too.
Oh, and I tell you, to this day, I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge fan of everybody that's been part of all of the programs that we're blessed to have, but specifically the F-15 program. Mm-hmm. It's a magnificent airplane. So think about it this way. Here it is, a young 20-something-year-old is given the keys to fly one of these machines that can go so fast. I mean, we're merging at 2,000 miles an hour, roughly, okay? Can go 9 times the force of gravity, can launch 8 air-to-air missiles and 940 rounds of an eternal gun to protect our great nation. So it was a dream come true, absolute dream come true. I graduated top of my class at F-15 school. I went to Eglin Air Force Base in Fort Walton Beach, Florida, and began to learn teamwork and how to become a member of a team of teams in the aviation context. Again, all of this taken for granted, but part of the program from day number one. And you mentioned at the top that I was a real-life maverick.
You really were.
I was because, and if you think about it, Maverick, if you go back now to Top Gun, the movie, Maverick was a solo operator until the very end where he has the epiphany that he really needs to be a good teammate. Mm-hmm. And then once he's a good teammate, the team wins, right? When he's operating as a solo operator, the team doesn't win. I picked the F-15 because I was tired of having somebody in my back seat offering me thoughts about how to land, how to take off, how to fly formation, how to do navigation, whatever the case was. I wanted to be by myself. Luckily, the Air Force taught me the lessons that we learned all the way back in World War I, that if I'm flying by myself, I'm going to get killed.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to have mutual support.
Right.
You have to.
Your wingman.
You have to have a wingman. Mm-hmm. And you're, one of the fundamental things that you do for one another is you look out for each other, literally the entire flight. So I picked that up, and all these things kind of came together, and it worked naturally to where I rapidly accelerated through my qualification program. I became an instructor pilot in the F-15, and I was asked to go to the Air Force Weapons Instructor Course, the Air Force version of Top Gun.
Mm-hmm. Right. I want to talk about one little story. So I think you had one of your students, and you guys were doing a, what would you call it?
A dogfight. Dogfight.
Right.
Yes.
Can you talk about that story? Do you know which one
yes.
I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
And your student?
Mm-hmm. It was one of those moments where it's surreal as it happens, and reflecting back on it, you go, holy cow. So the dogfight, the one versus one maneuver that we were flying that day, or the kind of profile we were flying, we got about 5 miles apart from one another, simulating that we had just seen each other and that we were both competitors. So we were going against mm-hmm. one another.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we saw each other, we turned towards each other and tried to position ourselves for this fight. And the intent of the fight was to get into a position to be able to employ weapons against the other one. And the person that could do that fastest and employ valid weapons wins. That's a very exciting profile. There's a lot of speed. There's mm-hmm. a lot of G's. You're fighting against the force of gravity. You're making really important judgments in a very time-limited sense. As we're turning towards one another, I'm trying to abide by the Air Force training rules, which say you need to have 500 feet of separation at the point where your airplanes pass. It's for safety.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're not in combat. We want to protect ourselves.
Right.
It's hard to judge 500 feet, frankly, but
I can't imagine
rules.
Going at the speed that you're going.
And the speeds we're going and the conditions, but you can sort of get it. You get mm-hmm. a sight picture for what that sort of looks like. So I'm aiming to get my 500 feet. And every time that I point in a given direction, my opponent mirrors me. So he points to the exact same piece of sky. So then I point away from him towards another piece of sky, and he mirrors me exactly. And you only have a few of these before you're at the merge. And I realize we are going to hit one another.
Right.
It was plain to me in my mind that this is going to be a mid-air collision, potentially of epic proportion. And goodness gracious, I can't believe it. So at the very last second, I do this last-ditch maneuver. And as his airplane goes by me, time slows down. I've read about this happening to people. It actually does take place. Time slows down. And as his airplane roared by mine, I could see each individual rivet.
I remember you
each
saying that.
Each individual rivet.
Yes.
You could see where the screws were. And he passes a couple of feet away from my airplane.
Yes.
And as I look back over my shoulder, I go, oh my gosh, he must have taken my tails off because, you know, they set a few feet up into the air. He missed that too, and we were okay.
Oh, just, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
If you didn't see your life pass before
yes.
your eyes.
Yes.
Amazing. What did you do then? It was a close call.
It was.
So
a very close
said,
call. So here's the takeaway. After that, and we had plenty of fuel left to go back and, you know, continue our training, those missions are really valuable. You got to maximize them every time that you have them because we don't fly as often as we'd like to or need to, frankly. But in this particular case where we almost hit one another, the only option was, and I called for it immediately, let's get back together. Let's go back home. Let's debrief this situation so we
mm-hmm.
find out, why did we almost hit one another so that we never do this again?
Why is that?
So great question. And when you look at fighter aviation specifically, we're pretty strict in the way that we go about our missions. We always start with planning. And that's foundational to the approach that we use across the military. But specifically in fighter aviation with high-performing fighter teams, we never go forth and just execute. We plan, not necessarily because of the plan that we come up with, because we know that the enemy gets a vote, all right? There's always going to be something that disrupts even the greatest plan, but it's the planning process that gets us to think through the threat, the weather, the intelligence that we have, the different options that we have based upon what we think we know, the assumptions we're making, the contingency plans we need to build to be effective when things start to fall apart, et cetera, all right? So we always start with planning. We try to be inclusive in our planning. So it's not just one leader that says, this is the plan. We bring in all of the teams together to plan collaboratively so that we come up with a really good plan.
Right.
But we know that not everybody can be part of that process, so we always start the mission the day of or the night of with the briefing of the plan, where we tell the story of how we're going to succeed. And truly, it's a story to include the good, the bad, and the ugly of what might happen, and then we go forth and execute. And then we never finish a mission until we've debriefed what it was that went down. And this debrief process, it's our practice of accountable leadership, where as teams, we go back and hold ourselves accountable for the decisions we made during the planning process, for the way that we communicated the plan to the members of our team, and then the way that we all individually executed during the course of the mission. It's a wonderful, wonderful process that traces its history all the way back to World War I, when the first fighter pilots learned it. The Germans did it first. They did it very effectively. Once the Allies figured it out, we became very effective at it, and we've been doing it ever since.
Mm-hmm. And so we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Rob Teschner. As a business leader, you know that keeping a solid first impression with your potential clients, customers, and talent is vital to reaching your organization's goals. If you haven't optimized your website, or if you don't even have a website, you're missing an opportunity to shape your first impression so that it shows your brand in the best possible light. If you're thinking about revolutionizing your website, let's talk. Our team at Technology Partners is ready to help you reshape your online presence. Go to tpi.co/websites and start your journey today. So, Rob, you just talked about planning, executing, and debriefing. Does this apply in other pieces of your life? Does this apply in business?
Absolutely. And in fact, what I would propose, Lisa, is that we hold off on me giving that full answer until we've explored a little bit about my personal life.
Right.
And then I'll try to bring this back in.
Oh, okay, that sounds good. Well, I do know you have a life interruption.
Yes.
And I want you to talk a little bit about that. What was that life interruption for you?
Okay, so I was privileged, among other things, to command an operational F-22 squadron as a lieutenant colonel. I went off to headquarters of U.S. European Command in Stuttgart, Germany for a staff assignment, a pretty good staff assignment, but I was called back from that pretty quickly to return to the F-22 in a more senior capacity. I was also selected for promotion to full colonel, so the career was going really, really, really well,
Absolutely.
Up until the point where I was diagnosed with rectal cancer. I mean, I joke about this, but, you know, I have friends that ask, is it too soon for us to make fun of you for the rectal cancer, right? So in February of 2014, my life was totally turned upside down. My wife was 4.5 months pregnant with our fourth child. We're overseas. We're trying to understand what are the ramifications. I ask the gentleman who would eventually become my surgeon, hey, can I go back and fly after we remove this huge chunk of my lower colon? He said, I would not recommend it. There's no guarantee that you won't fall apart or rip apart inside. You know, so we go from things are going great in life across the board to what can I do now? And in fact, really, the aftermath of the colon resection was much worse than any of the cancerous preparation stuff. And I was fortunate that I didn't have to do radiation or chemotherapy, but we still had a lot of anxiety about this. We had the surgeries to get ready for. We had multiple surgeries with some ramifications associated with them. But once I was put back together again, Lisa, my body was not functional. I could not live like a normal human being. And I was basically trapped. I mean, I could barely make it to work and back. I'll spare you the details, but it was a bad time, and it lasted for a number of years to the point where I thought to myself, I'm never going to get out of this. I couldn't take any of the jobs that I was offered. My wife and I chose to retire early and accept a reduction in rank so that we could come back to St. Louis, which I've always considered to be home, to have family nearby in case things go south again for me, so for contingency planning purposes. But I was left with very, very few options. I couldn't fly. I couldn't function. I was best in my own basement, and I couldn't even for the longest time be trusted to take care of our kids, you know, outside of the house because there was no guarantee that I could stay with them, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. All right, so it was a big life change.
Cannot even imagine. And, I mean, this has been your whole life, right?
Yes.
And your life's dream to do this.
That's
right. Had to have been just so hard on so many different levels. So talk to us about if you had employed the plan, execute, debrief, what could have been different, Ron?
Yes. All right. So let me lead into this by saying, Lisa, that everything that took place ended up being a tremendous blessing. At the time, we saw it as a tremendous blessing, if you can believe that. It meant a lot more time with the family. It meant, you know, an opportunity to hopefully throttle back a little bit from a real go, go, go mentality that we had while I was on active duty. There was an empathy that grew within me that hadn't existed prior to, just because I had never experienced
anything
sort of physical,
like
nothing like this, right? So, and the list of good goes on and on. So just please know that there's so much good that came from all of this. But at the end of the day, I am responsible for what it was that happened to me. And it all goes back down to the fact that while I was teaching, planning, briefing, executing, and debriefing at the highest possible level. I was the Air Force's subject matter expert for debriefing at our weapons school. I wasn't applying any of that as a life skill. It was something that I did at work. I did it very, very well at work, but I didn't connect the dots and see how this would be applicable at home. So here's the part that's painful to share, but must be shared in order for this story to have any goodness.
And
right?
for other people to learn from.
Yes, 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 yes. So the first indications that my personal system was not right or well were all the way back in 2003, early 2004. I'm a combat veteran. I'm a Top Gun instructor. I'm a busy guy. And I'm an American male, right? So my inclination to go do anything about this was very, very low. In fact, I didn't share any of this with anyone. Now, mind you, my wife, she really cares about me.
Mm-hmm.
She would have suggested that I do something about this. My doctors would have suggested that I do something, I think. My in-laws, my father-in-law is a doctor. My mother-in-law is a nurse. They would have suggested, I had a whole team there that could have potentially put me on the right path mm-hmm. to success, but I...
But you didn't tell anybody.
I didn't tell anybody.
Right.
I didn't see this as being mm-hmm. my team. My mm-hmm. team was at work. I was focused on work. Didn't have a home team in that sense, okay? So I didn't have a plan for my health and wellness. I certainly didn't communicate or brief my plan or mm-hmm. the absence thereof to anybody. As we went along, I never debriefed how it was that I was doing so that when the symptoms came back in 2013, I finally said, all right, I may want to now talk about this. I'm not currently flying, so there's an opportunity to get this addressed before I go back to the F-22. Told my wife, long story short, we went to see a German doctor. He said, I regret to inform you that you've got this huge tumor growing in your lower colon. I estimate it's been growing for 10 years. Now that...
Back to 2003.
Oh, yeah. I tell you what, the Germans are incredibly precise.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I'm very thankful for Dr. Meyer and the outstanding work that he did. He was 100% correct. So the takeaway for me on this is that my home team is the most important team that I'm on. And so let's work together as a team.
Mm-hmm.
Let's set our end state, our desired objectives, what it is that we want to do as a team together. Let's build an effective plan to get there. Let's communicate regularly.
And you have 5 kids.
I have 5 children.
And Rob, I bet you're doing things differently with them. I bet you guys are planning. I mean, there is so much wisdom packed into this.
Yes.
And I see this time and time again with type A supercharged people.
Yeah.
That sometimes they don't think those things apply to their family, but they do.
Yes.
You need a life plan. You need
yes.
to talk about those things.
Yes. There's a gentleman named Hal Elrod, the author of The Miracle Morning, okay? In his book, he talks about how you can be effectively a superstar in one phase of your life and kind of a dud in the others, right?
Yeah.
That was me to a T. So what I'm interested in is how do you effectively get those parts that you're currently not doing so well in up to the same level as the superstar part of you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this planning, mm-hmm. briefing, executing, and debriefing, mm-hmm. it works. It just works. It works for faith. It works for relationships. It works for health and wellness. It works for... There's no domain in which you can't apply this to extreme effect.
Huge takeaway.
Mm-hmm.
I have a dear friend. He's actually been on the podcast, Jack Lanham. And he talks about there are 6 dimensions of the human well-being, and you've got to look at all of those, and you know, hopefully it's a perfect circle.
Yes.
But sometimes it can be a lopsided circle.
Yes.
And so it's just, if there is a takeaway here, you've got to focus on all of those things and prioritize, right? Because mm-hmm. it starts at home.
I mean, if it doesn't, then there's going to be big problems.
Mm-hmm.
And we experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned that there was so much good that came of this, Lisa, and I will reemphasize that my life was saved by my beautiful bride, Diane. First doctor that I went to see said, you're young, you're fit, you're fine, don't worry about it. The second one said the same thing. She insisted that I keep on going back. And the other piece is my beautiful children, there were 4 at the time, 3 of whom were, you know, aware of what was going on. They showed unconditional love to me through the most dark time in my life. I mean, the painful mm-hmm. recovery from this was truly horrific.
Mm-hmm.
They were fantastic. I'll always be thankful to them for that. And the good just keeps on piling. The mother-in-law, my mom, everybody that just came and supported us and helped us.
So much packed in there.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about, oh goodness, we could just go on and on and on about different lessons. But, you know, I know that our listening audience is going to be inspired. I think that they're going to be encouraged. I think that they're going to be, hopefully, a bias toward action from listening to your story, Rob.
Yes.
But this is the Something Extra podcast. Let's talk about the something extra that every leader needs.
Okay, so, and it's something that I see often misapplied in a number of different ways. So I'll offer taking full ownership of whatever it is that we're doing. And by that I mean to say, if we've got a program that we're responsible for, if there's a system that, you know, is ours, we as leaders take full responsibility for seeing this thing through no matter what it takes. And that's not to say that we work 200-hour weeks, mm-hmm. even if that's possible. I don't mm-hmm. know if mathematically you can get there. But the point is, we take full responsibility for doing whatever it takes to get the mission accomplished, right? Total ownership of it. There's no blaming anybody else when things don't go right. We take ownership for getting this thing across mm-hmm. the line. Mm-hmm. Tied to that, what's equally important is that we share the successes that take place there. All right, and I saw a beautiful example of this. I volunteer some of my time at a hospital here working on their patient safety committee. One of their teams had been working real hard on a patient safety initiative. It was a really tough initiative. And we came in for one of our monthly meetings, and they had achieved what it was that they had set out to, which many people thought they wouldn't be able to. And the young nurse who was in charge, when she was congratulated for the job that she had done as the leader, said, "It's not me, it's the team. They overcame everything and got this thing done." Now, there's no doubt in my mind that if things hadn't gone well, she would have accepted full responsibility mm-hmm. and would have come up with a plan for how it was that sure. they were going to redirect. But when they achieved it, she immediately deflected any of the celebration.
Any of the glory.
Any of the glory. And she meant it. This is the part that told me that she truly owned it. She meant that her team had done what needed to be done. And I saluted her then, and I still think back on that as an outstanding example. I learned from her that day of mm-hmm. the kind of leader that I'd like to be, mm-hmm. you know, for my teams.
Right. Oh, that's perfect. I love that. Well, I want to give you the opportunity, if there's anything that you've got coming up that's really exciting, I want to give you the opportunity to talk about that and how our listeners can get plugged in.
You're very, very gracious, Lisa, so thank you for this. I will tell you that we're coming up on the 5-year anniversary of the first surgery. It's March 13th, and that's kind of a big day in the cancer mm-hmm. you know, story. And so the way that we're celebrating that in the Teschner household is we're releasing my very first book, Debrief to Win. And this is a labor of love. It's telling the story of what it is that I learned as the subject matter expert for the Air Force on how to do this accountability stuff mm-hmm. for a high-performing team. Mm-hmm. And it's captured in a way that makes it really relatable. So it comes out on March 13th. And if your listeners are so inclined, I would love it if they'd go to Amazon and maybe pick up a copy. It'll be in hardcover and also in paperback. But that would be the day to do it. We're going to reclaim March 13th as being an awesome, happy, wonderful day in our household.
I love it. I love it. Yes, and I have a copy of the book, yes. and it is just chock full of great lessons. And so if you've enjoyed just this little snippet of what you've heard from Rob, get the book, or Cujo, I should say.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Get the book, and you can take a deeper dive. So thank you so much for being with us. This has just been a pleasure.
Lisa, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you for having me on here today.
Our show today is executive produced by Brian Muncy. Our technical producer is Daniel Williams. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2018. For show notes or to reach out to Lisa, visit lisagailnichols.com/somethingextra. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen.